Call the next case, please. You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Andrew Felice. I represent the appellant, Synchronized Construction Services Incorporated. With me today is my co-counsel, James Higginbotham. This case comes before the court on an appeal from... This case comes before the court on an appeal from a circuit court matter dismissing a mechanics lien suit for failure to have, what the circuit court believes, a necessary party before the court. The case originated out of a construction of a Best Western hotel in Orange, Virginia. My client was a subcontractor. The construction manager, Paris Development Corporation, and the owner was Prave Lodge LLC, and the construction financing was done through the appellee Virginia Community Bank.
So, counsel, what is the effect of the bond?
The effect of the bond, there is really no effect to the bond. The bond is merely a substitution under 4370 for the real property, which is the security for the mechanics lien. So the bonding off of the mechanics lien had no effect in this case. My client is required, and would be if the case continued, to prove its mechanics lien as if the bond was not there and the property was.
One of the effects would be there would be no impact on the title to this property.
Correct. The lien has already been released of record by order of the court, and the cash bond that was posted essentially became the security. The cash bond has obviously been released pursuant to the judgment below, and we would require it to be reinstated.
So we don't need anything about the deed of the trustee or the deed of trust that need to be involved anymore?
Correct. Correct. They do no longer have an interest, a property interest in the litigation that could be defeated or diminished by the enforcement of the.
So that
litigation.
Is an impact, obviously.
Certain
parties don't need to be here anymore.
So certain parties, it doesn't impact the decision, the issue before the court. If I may be clear, the appellees in their brief, counsel,
while we're trying to establish who should or should not needs to or does not need to be there. The property is no longer a party. The trust holders perhaps no longer need to be parties. What about other subcontractors? Let's say there are, when you're looking at the vertical relationship, you go from owner to general to you. Let's say that you now look horizontally and you find three more of you. Are they necessary parties in an action?
If they have mechanics lien. And in this case,
they don't have mechanics.
If they do not have mechanics, they do not have an interest in the real property.
But the real property is no longer a party to the suit.
The real property is no longer in the party to the suit, but the basis for a mechanics lien recovery, be it even after it's bonded off, we have to prove that my client essentially would have been able to sell the property and obtain proceeds from the property to satisfy that lien. The bond is only there for payment of that end result. So in this case, the subcontractors that had recorded a mechanics lien were included as parties to the suit initially. All of the other subcontractors failed to perfect their liens and were dismissed because they failed to perfect their liens and they had no longer an interest in the property the underlying interest, and no longer an interest in a mechanics lien enforcement suit because they did not have their own mechanics lien. If they had bare contract claims against the construction manager, they don't have a property interest that can be defeated or diminished in this case because they only have a contract claim, their own contract claim against the general contractor. Never been held that a subcontractor who merely holds a contractual claim against the general contractor must be a necessary party to another subcontractor's mechanics lien action. You must have a property interest that can be defeated, diminished under the Mendenhall versus Cooper case in 1990, Justice Stevenson wrote. The issue comes before the court today is whether the construction manager is a necessary party. The court below ruled that the construction manager was a necessary party because his interest was bound up in the determination of my client's claim. We believe that was an error. Under the Mendenhall v. Cooper case and other cases that came after that, the standard is whether that party had whether the missing party had a possessory or expectancy interest that can be defeated or diminished.
If the managing partner, right, is not party to this suit, doesn't that party have a right to say, well, I would have gotten where it was commissioned, where it was from the owner, and I have a right to come in and show that, as opposed to what the subcontractor.
We don't deny that the construction manager or the general contractor, if you want to use the verbiage in this situation, would have had a contract claim against the owner for potential monies due under its contract. And I'll address it in a second. But you have to look at it as a two-phase analysis, which the court below did not. Court stopped at they were bound up. The general contractor, construction manager, was bound up in the financial arrangements, and therefore is a necessary party.
Let's look at whether they are in fact bound up. The owner in a mechanics lien suit doesn't owe any more under the lien than the general contractor owed to the sub. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor, in part. We need to prove that at the time my client filed a mechanics lien, monies were due and owing under the prime contract at the time. That my client's suit.
That's the first half of what has to be proven. The second half of what has to be proven is that it flows down one more pool. You have to show that there was money flowing down from the owner to the general.
Yes, Your Honor.
But likewise, you have to show the portion of that would have flowed down to you as opposed to flowing out to others. Do you not?
Yes, Your Honor. And that's part of our proof, and we're fully capable of proving.
And in our adversarial system, you may be able to put on the proof, but who can offer the defense that says, no, that's not the right amount of money, that you were not owed that much for the following reasons?
Well, certainly the owner can.
How can the owner do so? Your contract is with the general contractor, with the owner.
The owner has all of, in this case, the job was 99% done.
We're looking, have to look beyond this case. So the owner might not even know who the subcontractors are.
That very well may be. They have all the billings or access to all the billings on the job that the contractor incurs through the life of the job.
So in our adversarial system, who is there to oppose your contract claims that are bound up within the mechanics lien?
Both in this case, the owner and any other party who has an interest in the property can certainly oppose it. You're talking about the quality of the proof. For example, if the general contractor essentially doesn't show up and doesn't cooperate in with the owner, leaves the jurisdiction, like in this case, and is not available to be deposed or testify, can the subcontractor's mechanics lien be stopped and said, well, the quality of the proof that the owner or the interested party can bring is not sufficient, so therefore, Mr. Mechanics Lien claimant, you can't go forward.
But in the hypothetical that we have to address, we would never know that, because we can't have one rule for when you named the party and then didn't exercise diligence to gain a judgment, and another rule for when you never named the party.
I respectfully disagree. If the analysis is the party missing, do they have a possessory or expectancy interest in the claim? In our situation,
if they don't,
in our situation,
then why would you even have to name them? Why would you even have had to file against them?
We asserted a breach of contract claim against that party. Against the subcontractors, if you look at the complaint, who filed the mechanics lien, we said these are proper parties because they have or may have an interest in the property. They essentially were there for the mechanics lien adjudication. But in this case, the construction manager was under a cost reimbursable contract. And a second contract, what we call the September 2009 contract, which one essentially stripped the construction manager of the right to be paid for the subcontractor's work. No longer was the payments going to be flowed through the general construction manager. No longer was the construction manager.
Now, there's an argument by the other side that that issue is not even before us, the 2009 contract, because it wasn't raised below. Respond to that before you go into detail as to what the 2009 contract.
I believe that is not correct. Their issue on the brief was that we raised the point that the Parish Development Corporation, there was no evidence that they fulfilled all the requirements of its contract to have a claim. Essentially, that's not correct. We essentially raised the point that in this situation, Paris Development doesn't have any claims to the money that we're seeking. It's a cost-reimbursable contract. If we don't recover the money that we're seeking, they don't recover the money because they hadn't paid to us. But on the point of whether they had fulfilled, essentially, Paris Development, all of their contract requirements, the appellees below were the movements. They had the burden of proof on whether, if their position is that the missing party had contract claims that needed to be protected by the process of due process and needed to be a party to this particular lien exercise, they should have put on proof of that. There is no proof below that in the record that the construction manager fulfilled all of the payment requirements of the construction manager, all of the claims requirements of the construction manager, or all of the change order requirements. What we do know is the last payment to the construction manager, as evidenced by the escrow agreements log, was in November 2009. They left the job in January 2010. There was no evidence that they made any further attempts to be paid or claimed to be paid. The construction manager was only going to be paid after September 2009 for the work the construction manager did. If it did none, it received no payments. If the subcontractors worked, they would have received payments through the distribution system that was set up by the September 2009 contract. So essentially, what we have here is that after September 2009, the construction manager had no justifiable claims. And in the record below, because it went out on a motion to dismiss, and there was no evidentiary hearings, is void of any proof that the construction manager had viable claims after it left the job.
Was your client a party to that contract that was signed in the fall of that year, 2009?
No, Your Honor. That was between the owner, the construction manager, and was approved, signed by the lender. The subcontractors had no involvement in the negotiation or issuance of that contract. I have about a minute and a half left. I'd like to reserve my time.
All right.
May it please the court, my name is Alex Burnett, and I represent the Appalese Virginia Community Bank and Paul S. Bliley, Jr., trustee. I'd like to briefly respond to the point Mr. Felice just made because I think it's an important one that the construction manager, as he calls him, I'm going to call him the general contractor because in this case that's the same thing, that the general contractor didn't have any claims after the September 2009 amendment. And Your Honors, that first of all, that demonstrates precisely why we need the general contractor in this case, because the appellant, the subcontractor, wants to argue that the general contractor has no claim and has no rights. And at the same time, it was the subcontractor who didn't serve. While he did name him in the suit, he didn't serve him, and so the general contractor is not before the court because of because of the subcontractor's failure. So on the one hand, he wants to say that he's not necessary and doesn't need to be here. On the other hand, he wants to prove all of the general contractor's rights and obligations. But the important thing here is that the general contractor may have claims, and the general contractor due process requires that the general contractor ought to be given notice and an opportunity to be heard on those issues. And here's how I think the general contractor may have claims. It starts with an analysis of the prime contract. Mr. Police focuses on the fact that after the September 2009 contract, the general contractor can't be reimbursed for subcontractor costs. And while that's true, that doesn't take into account the other things that the general contractor can be reimbursed for, even after the September 2009 amendment. Namely, the general contractor is still entitled to reimbursement for its fixed fee. Its cost plus a fixed fee, and in this case the fixed fee was $192,000. That fixed fee is paid out over the duration of the project, so at each draw request, the general contractor could get its percentage portion of that fee. Notably, also, retainage is taken out throughout the duration of that project. So even on the fixed fee, at the end of the project, the general contractor would be entitled to 10% of the $192,000. That's the fee. But in addition to the fixed fee, the general contractor is also entitled to reimbursement for its labor, materials, and other miscellaneous costs. So, for example, throughout the duration of the project, the general contractor would be entitled in its draw request to not only include the monies expended by the subs, but also the monies that the general contractor spent. And that not only includes the wages of its employees, but it involves the salary of its superintendent. And on draw number 10, Joint Appendix page 190, you'll see a claim by the general contractor for $16,000 for its superintendent costs. Draw number 10, by the way, was the last draw that the general contractor submitted. So it's entitled to those reimbursables for its own expenses, including its superintendent, throughout the duration of the project. So during the project, they get all of those reimbursables. At the end of the project, the general contractor would be entitled to all of its retainage, not just the $19,000 for its fee, but also the retainage for the rest of its reimbursables. As it goes along, 10% is being taken out every time. The general might have a claim for that. And for any other reimbursables that it hadn't been paid yet. So I think the point here is that it's important that the general contractor may have claims, and in draw 10 asserted claims. And it's not here, it hasn't been made a party to this case to assert those claims or to defend the subcontractor's assertion that it's not entitled to those.
Let me ask you a question or two. Certainly it seems like the general contractor would want to be a party to this action. And there's nothing to prevent him from joining the action, I'm sure, is there? He could have joined the action at any point in time that the court, he asked to leave the court let him join the action. The question, I guess, is whether this whole claim against this sum of money now is defeated under mechanics lien law, which is a very statutorily bound set of laws, and we've always said, although we did say that necessary parties are not necessarily determined by the statute, but by a due process analysis. But don't his claims survive the divvying up of this fund of money? Can't he come back at some later time and file an action against the owner or the subs or anybody else who he thinks has gotten more of that share than they're entitled to get? Can he do that?
That's a great question, and it's important to this case, and the answer to that is no. Because...
Why not for a reach, Yukata?
Well, perhaps, but more importantly, I think there's a clearer answer than that. The one important thing that the September 2009 amendment did was it created a guaranteed maximum price, whereas under the original prime contract, there was no cap. The owner would have to pay the general contractor for all of its reimbursables. Under the September 2009 amendment to the contract, that changed, and now all of a sudden there's a cap on how much the owner has to pay out. Take, for example, if you look at page 11 of the appellant's opening brief, they've got a little chart there that says amount due left under the contract based on the guaranteed maximum price, and then it shows the amounts paid, and it concludes that there's $173,586 left to be paid under the prime contract from the owner to the general contractor. But what's critical here is that the lien claimant's mechanics lien was for $208,000. So under the appellant's scenario, the lien claim couldn't be paid in full. It could be paid a max of $173,000. And if that full $173,000 is paid to the lien claimant under this bond, and the full funds under the bond are paid out to the lien claimant, there would be nothing left over to satisfy any claim that the general contractor had. So the general contractor is finished once that bond is paid out.
I guess that's some of money, but he still could go back against the sub or the owner, or couldn't he?
I don't think he could go back against the owner, because once the $173,000 is paid out, that guaranteed maximum price, that cap under the September 2009 amendment, has been paid, and the owner shouldn't have to pay anything more than that. I suppose that's the risk if the general contractor were to come back later and say, I wasn't a party to this, my due process, you know, I didn't have my due process, and I should be able to prove that I'm owed the money. Now, all of a sudden, the owner, who had paid out the $173,000 and arguably had paid out the full amount under that cap, now all of a sudden the owner is subject to a second litigation, which is expensive and time-consuming, and the risk that the second court might find differently and find that the general contractor does owe money. If on the other hand, the court in that second subsequent litigation found that the cap was in place and that it had already been paid out, now all of a sudden the general contractor is finished. They lost their rights in that claim when this court adjudicated the subcontractor's bond claim.
Is that a proper party analysis you've just given us, or is it a necessary party analysis?
I believe it's necessary because the general contractor has property rights that are at risk here, real property rights. If the general contractor, if the sub proved
contract rights, not real property rights, it
is derived from contract, but I believe he's got a right, or he's got a claim to the funds that are subject to this case, because those funds are capped, because there's a ceiling on how much can be paid out. I believe that the general contractor's got to be a necessary party to this suit, because if the trial court in this case were to find that $173,000 should be paid to the sub, then the general contractor loses its claim, loses its right to any further payment,
well,
potentially.
I want to segregate the real property analysis, because that is the essence of the mechanics lien law. That's why we have necessary parties in the mechanics lien law, because it does have an effect on titled property. We don't have that anymore, because this bond has taken that all away. So we're now just talking about contract rights, right?
Contract rights and rights to those funds, rights to the money that's been put up as part of the bond. That's now what's at stake, and it's a fight potentially between the general contractor and the subcontractor over who's entitled to those funds that are subject to that bond.
If I understand you correctly, then your argument is premised on a particular provision of this contract that caps what the general contractor can claim overall from the owner. That might not be in other contracts.
That's right.
So a finding that that this particular general contractor is a necessary party in this particular litigation might not necessarily spill over and be applicable if you had a different contract.
Well, I think that's where the trial court's analysis comes in, and I think the general contractor could be necessary in all cases, because as Justice Mims alluded to earlier, the general contractor has rights that are being litigated in this case. Like it or not, the subcontractor is one of the elements that he has to prove of this mechanics lien is that, number one, that the owner owes money downstream to the general, and number two, that the general owes money downstream to the sub. Our general in this case is necessary and intricate in both of those analyses because you're litigating literally every contractual and financial interest with respect to the prime contract between the owner and the general and with respect to the subcontract between the subcontractor and the general. And so
the subcontractor's rights are derivative of the general contractor's rights. They can't rise any higher. The subcontractor can never claim any more than the general contractor would have been able to claim.
That's exactly right. And so
once the owner has paid the sub that amount of money, the general contractor may have a valid claim that's now moot.
That's exactly right. So in order, and that's really the rationale behind the trial court's decision was that...
The code says that it's an affirmative defense as to whether the owner is indebted to the general contractor. Was that something that the sub has to prove, or is that something that the missing general contractor has to prove, or is that something that you would have to prove?
That's a good question, Your Honor. That's a good question, Your Honor. 43.7 is this code section you're referring to, and I think it says it both ways. It says it does have the affirmative defense sentence, but the sentence right before that says that the subcontractor can't recover any more than has been paid. So I think the burden is still on the subcontractor to prove the amount that the general still has, that there's still money to be paid under the prime contract. But regardless, I mean, in this case, there was, this was asserted as an affirmative defense, and this was an issue in the case about how much was left to be paid under the prime contract. And so either way, it was part of the subject matter of this case because it was a necessary and intricate part to proving the elements of the mechanics lien. So that's really what the trial court found. The trial court found that the subject matter involved all of the elements of the mechanics lien because, as Mr. Felice said, even though the bond was put in place, the sub still had the burden of proving that the mechanics lien was valid. So as part of that, in determining whether the mechanics lien was valid, the trial court would have had to determine whether or not there was money left to be paid under the prime contract and also whether there was money left to be paid under the subcontract. So the general contractor's rights, liabilities, claims vis-a-vis the owner would have been litigated. The general contractor's rights, claims, obligations vis-a-vis the subcontractor would have been litigated. I think it's also very interesting to note that in that draw number 10 I've been talking about, on page 1, it's about 185, 186, 187, where it lists synchronized. It says synchronized has been paid in full 100% and is 100% complete.
Does that indicate under that particular draw, is this a segmented contract? So would that indicate for the work done during that period of time they were 100% paid, or does that mean that their contract has been 100% satisfied?
That indicates, Your Honor, that their contract has been 100% satisfied. It's not just for that particular draw. It's for the whole project. And I'm not trying to say that to prove that that's, in fact, the case. But the point is the general contractor may have something to say about whether the subcontractor is entitled to any money. And it materially affects the general contractor because if the subcontractor is entitled to money, the general contractor's claims are at least diminished, but probably defeated altogether because of that guaranteed maximum price cap. Your Honor, for all of these reasons, we would ask that the court affirm the decision of the trial court.
All right, thank you. Rebuttal?
Thank you. To address some of the issues that counsel just raised, with regard to whether the construction manager in this case may have had a claim, there's no evidentiary hearing on this matter. We proffered certain matters before the court, but it took no evidence. The court never ruled on the amount the balance due the general contractor at any period of time. Counsel talks about the claims that they may have. Justice asked about whether the contract had any impact on it. It does. For example, there were 16 mechanics liens. Under the prime contract, once a mechanics lien is filed by a sub, the owner's right or obligation to pay the general contractor no longer exists. That's a defense. So put aside my client's mechanics lien, just the mere fact that others had mechanics lien, the general contractor didn't have a claim to payment unless they can show that that had been satisfied. Under the mechanics lien statute, once a mechanics lien is filed by a subcontractor, the owner has the right to retain payment and not pay the general contractor. That's their obligation to protect themselves from essentially going to further in debt. There are numerous final payment provisions. Council talked about retainage. Retainage isn't due unless it's due under the contract. They have put on no proof that the general contractor has fulfilled those terms to have a claim. Now we're talking about whether a necessary party versus a proper party. A necessary party has to have a viable claim. They might have a colorable claim. They might think they have a claim, but that doesn't make them a necessary party. I see my time is up. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Still attached. It's caught.
Just drop it in there.